from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, two stories on guns in America. The Senate is set to vote on four gun control proposals.
If you cannot fly, you should not be able to buy an assault weapon.
There's no due process because we don't even know how you get on that list. I mean, I've been called a domestic terrorist by some people.
And the latest in a Connecticut case challenging gun manufacturers' federally granted immunity.
Okay, Mr. Remington executive, is it worth it? It's not a legal question, it's a moral one.
Also today, building a human genome from scratch. Harvard geneticist George Church says it's coming, but can ethics keep up with the science?
I like to bring up these things as far in advance as you can, although it seems like we're driving faster through the fog than ever before. We're getting a little ahead of our headlights.
All that, and was Herman Melville in love with Nathaniel Hawthorne? Coming up next on Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with two stories about guns in America. The U.S. Senate is scheduled to take a vote on several gun control measures later today. More on that in a moment. Also today in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a crucially important hearing in a lawsuit that challenges federally granted immunity to gun manufacturers. The suit is being brought by the families of victims of the Newtown school shooting. They're suing firearm manufacturer Remington, a distributor and the seller of the weapon the shooter used to kill 26 people at Sandy Hook Elementary School in December 2012. Matthew Soto was 15 years old when his little sister Victoria was killed at Sandy Hook. He spoke before court began today.
I know the firsthand effects of an assault rifle. I was present at the firehouse on 12/14/12 when 25 other families learned that our loved ones were killed after hours of sitting, hoping and praying that they were alive. On 6/16, as I heard the news from Orlando, so many emotions went through me, from horror to sadness, grief and disgust. As I watched the news that day, I went back to that horrible day in December.
Well, joining us now with more on the case is John Dankosky. He's executive editor of the New England News Collaborative, and he joins us from the studios of WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. John, good to have you.
Thanks so much.
So first of all, the actual trial here in this case isn't scheduled to start for 2 years, but what happened in this sort of pretrial hearing today?
Yeah, first of all, it is a little bit unusual for a case like this even to make it this far. That's why we're paying so much attention here. It might not have made it that far if not for it being in Connecticut, a state with pretty tight gun laws. Instead of federal court, a lot of cases like this have not been quite as successful. Today's hearing was essentially over whether or not this case has merit. If the judge finds that it does, as you say, there's a court date set for early 2018, so there's still a long way to go between now and then.
Mm-hmm. So what's at the heart of the case, of the lawsuit that the family members and victims of Sandy Hook are bringing against Remington and the distributor and the seller?
Well, there's this law that was passed by Congress back in 2005. It's called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, and it essentially shields gun makers from liability when guns are used in a crime. Now, back then, if you'll remember, the bill was seen as a top priority of the National Rifle Association, which was facing a series of lawsuits from individuals and also from towns and cities. This law, when it was signed in 2005, got pretty broad bipartisan support, both Democrats and Republicans. Now, the Senate is debating gun control measures right now. The lawyer behind this case, Josh Koskoff, says that the lawsuit here is about something different than the laws that Congress writes. Let's listen to him talking outside the courtroom before the hearing today.
It's vitally important that these two branches of government leave each other alone and that the laws of Congress, which can be influenced by industries like the gun industry, are not then held up in a court of law to say, see, what do you want from us? We sold a legal weapon. Well, when you influence the laws, you can make pretty much any weapon legal you want to.
So that's the argument vis-a-vis what the plaintiffs are saying, why the case should go forward. As you said, that's Joshua Koskoff, the plaintiff's attorney. What was the argument then made by Remington today? Because they claim that the case has no standing.
Yeah, so the law that was written back in 2005 shields the gun maker from lawsuits that stem from, quote, a properly functioning product, even one that is used illegally. So basically, if you use a gun to shoot someone, that's what the gun is supposed to do, say the gun makers. Now, it doesn't shield lawmakers or gun makers, excuse me, from the types of claims you might make against a product that doesn't work. For instance, if a gun didn't work and blew up in someone's hands, the manufacturer could still be sued. So this lawsuit takes a kind of a different tack. It says that the AR-15, which was originally built by Armalite as a military weapon back at the time of the Vietnam War, is a weapon of war. And it brings into question a loophole that the plaintiffs are trying to exploit called negligent entrustment. What this means is like a maker of a product or the seller of the product could be held liable for selling it to someone who they know might use it in a harmful or destructive way. The lawyers for Remington, Magna, say they couldn't possibly know that when they make a gun that's legal to purchase on the market, that someone might use it like this, that they might use it to commit a terrible crime.
Right. So we actually have some tape from Remington defense attorney James Votes exactly on this point.
If a manufacturer is not there to assess the incompetency or competency of the entrustee, how can it ever be shown that the manufacturer knew or reasonably should have known of that person's incompetence? That's what negligent entrustment law is in the state of Connecticut. That's where it is throughout this country.
So, John, I'm curious, how narrow is that window of negligent entrustment? I mean, he's pointing to specifically how it's seen in Connecticut.
Well, it's fairly narrow in the way that it's written. But what the plaintiffs are saying is, hold up, this is a gun that was made for use on the battlefield. It's marketed to civilians with all the trappings of a military-grade weapon. And what they're arguing is that the gun makers are essentially negligently entrusting a weapon to a population that doesn't have either the skill or the training to use these weapons. It is, I think many legal scholars say, a stretch, but it is also the first time a case like this has gotten quite this far. And I've talked to some lawyers who've said that this is an unusual and interesting legal tack, a way at getting at this gun law in a way that people haven't tried before.
Right. So today's hearing was held in the courtroom of Superior Court Judge Barbara Bellis. And John, if I remember correctly, she was the same judge who was allowing the case to go forward to begin with. Is that right?
That's right. And so the case was allowed to go forward. Essentially, she said some time ago that there is jurisdiction in this case. Today's hearing was just about whether or not there are merits in the case. We're not sure when we're going to hear from her again on that. And if we have a trial, it will be quite a while until we actually have a trial in Bridgeport. There was some talk today about whether parts of this case might have to be heard by the Connecticut State Supreme Court, some very technical parts of the case which might go to another court. And we haven't heard any more on that yet.
Okay. So because we have a little bit of tape again from inside the courtroom today, and it's a particular line of questioning or an observation that Judge Barbara Bellis made today, where she's comparing how society's thinking about these sort of semi-automatic rifles to how perhaps society looks at cigarettes. Let's listen.
You know, years ago, cigarettes, I don't know that at least the public didn't consider them unsafe, perhaps, but I don't think anybody now would argue that cigarettes are safe. I mean, it's just times change. Society changes, so what cigarettes are legal, but I think that the society has changed on how safe they may or may not be.
So, John, does this give us into any kind of window into how Judge Bellis might be thinking about today's pretrial hearing?
Well, I think it does say something that she's talking about that in court, that she decided that this case could indeed get this far. And it echoes what we've heard from a lot of legal scholars. I mean, we talked to John Thomas, a professor of law and public health at Quinnipiac University, who said that knife manufacturers don't get this kind of immunity, lawnmower manufacturers don't get this kind of immunity, but Congress decided to immunize gun makers and dealers from lawsuits based on acts committed with their products. Essentially, I think what some of the legal scholars and the judge in this case are saying is times have changed a little bit since 2005, and we certainly, sadly, have had so many more cases like this that both state houses and also the Congress are considering questions of whether or not the laws that we have are the laws that we should have moving forward regarding guns like the AR-15.
So we'll see what happens regarding today's hearing. But John, before I let you go, another quick question about Connecticut gun laws, because just in the aftermath of the Newtown shooting in April 2013, Connecticut passed a ban on military-style semi-automatic rifles. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court had the opportunity to weigh in on that ban because there's been a challenge to it. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, essentially, the U.S. Supreme Court said that they are not going to hear a challenge to this law. Similar laws were passed in the wake of the Newtown shooting in Connecticut and New York. Essentially, they're bans of weapons like this, semi-automatic military-style assault weapons. In their petition to the Supreme Court, the Connecticut Citizens Defense League and others charged that banning a particular class of firearms was unconstitutional. They said that an earlier high court ruling that protects the use of firearms owned by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes would actually hold in this case, but the Supreme Court said no, the Connecticut law is lawful. They're not going to hear this case. So for gun rights advocates in Connecticut, really two big wins today. Just even this hearing getting this far in the state case, and then also the U.S. Supreme Court deciding to uphold the Connecticut gun ban.
That's John Dankosky, executive editor of the New England News Collaborative, speaking to us from WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. John, thank you so much.
Happy to do it, Meghna.
All right. Well, let's move from Connecticut and New England to the U.S. Senate, because as we mentioned a little earlier, the Senate is poised to vote on four gun control measures later today. The action follows a filibuster last week by Senate Democrats who demanded votes on the issue following the shooting massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Among those pushing for stronger gun control laws is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, who supports a measure that would prevent anyone on a federal terrorist watch list from buying a gun. Markey says he's ready to take on the NRA and its support in Congress on the issue.
We are going to have that vote. It will be the showdown. If you cannot fly, you should not be able to buy an assault weapon or any weapon in the United States.
Well, joining us with more is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's been following the debate. Anthony, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So first of all, lay out exactly what's happening in the Senate today.
All right. Well, as you said, four different measures are being debated. And let's start with that proposal to prevent anyone on a government terrorist watch list from buying a gun. Dianne Feinstein of California is pushing this one. Republicans and the NRA oppose it. They say these lists are secret. There's no way to know for sure who's on it, if you're on it, if I'm on it. So here's Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts. That's the local affiliate of the NRA, who says this kind of law is a threat to lawful gun owners.
There's no due process because we don't even know how you get on that list. I mean, I've been called a domestic terrorist by some people who hate firearms, hate gun owners, don't want anybody to own a gun. So who's determining who gets on that list? I mean, from what I understand, there's been members of Congress that have been placed on that list and have had a hard time getting off.
So, Anthony, is that true? I think I've heard it before, but is it true that members of Congress have been put on the list?
Well, actually, this is one of the myths that dates back many years when the late Senator Edward Kennedy was supposedly placed on one of these lists by accident and couldn't get on his plane. But the story is not true. It was vetted by factcheck.org. And what happened was that TSA officials confused Kennedy's name with another person named Kennedy who had been selected for additional screening. So it was a mistake, but it was easily rectified. Mm-hmm. Kennedy was not on the terrorist watch list. He ultimately boarded his flights. He didn't miss any flights. But Senate Republicans say people could be denied their Second Amendment rights. So here's Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, on why he opposes Feinstein's measure.
You know, we don't want terrorists to get guns, but this has to be done in a constitutional way. And the proposal that Senator Feinstein and Senate Democrats have floated out is that if your name appears on a secret list, that you can be denied your Second Amendment rights. This isn't like getting on an airplane. That's not a constitutional right. This is pretty serious stuff.
Okay, Anthony, so what would Senator Cornyn propose instead?
All right, so this leads us to the second amendment that's being debated today. Cornyn's idea is to block gun sales to anyone on the terror watch list, but only if the attorney general can prove to a judge within 3 days of the attempted sale that there's probable cause to suspect that the buyer has credible links to terrorism. Mm. Democrats say that time frame, that 3 days, would make it virtually impossible to prevent someone suspected of terrorist links from buying a weapon. And they basically accuse Republicans of saying they're doing something when they're doing nothing. So the two sides are pretty far apart on this issue.
Which seems rather typical about these conversations. But speaking of the two sides being far apart, Democrats are also hoping to expand background checks. What's happening with that?
Right. So this is a measure being pushed by Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who led that 15-hour filibuster last week that Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren joined, among others. He wants to close the so-called gun show loophole. That would require every gun purchaser to go through a background check. As the law stands now, as you know, only guns bought from licensed dealers are subject to the checks. But private sales between individuals or at thousands of gun shows across the country or online purchases are not subject to checks. Mm-hmm. And this is similar to a proposal that lawmakers tried to push through in 2013 after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. It failed, and it failed in a Senate, by the way, that was controlled by Democrats. So nobody is expecting this to pass this time either. Republicans instead are getting behind a proposal by Charles Grassley of Iowa, who wants to provide more funding for the agency that runs background checks, but the measure would not expand background checks. So once again, the two sides very far apart on this issue.
Which again, as we keep saying, we say it over and over again. But you know, here we are, Anthony, in the wake of the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history in Orlando. And once again, it doesn't sound like Congress is poised to do very much. I mean, they're going to take a vote, but you know, what could actually change? I mean, so talk us through the big picture here. What is actually going on?
Yeah, well, what's going on, it seems to be what goes on every time there's a mass shooting. It's become a bit of a routine. There's a mass shooting. The nation's lawmakers tweet and make speeches. They express their sorrow and solidarity with the victims. Then nothing happens. I mean, we mentioned that even after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, where 20 children were slaughtered by a man with a semi-automatic assault-style rifle, Congress couldn't act. There have been a thousand mass shootings since then. After the San Bernardino killings, Congress didn't act. So this remains such a divisive issue, Meghna. The two sides just seem to talk past each other. The gun lobby still has enormous power and influence. And even though surveys show that a big majority of Americans favor reasonable gun control measures, not a whole lot happens. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, because I sort of asked him this when he was in town. And by the way, he's back in town today talking about this issue. We talked to him last week about what makes him think something can happen this time. And he says the fact that Congress is being forced to debate just a few days after the Orlando killings represents a kind of progress. Here's what he said.
I think now, after the Pulse Club massacre, the people understand that terrorists can be buying these guns. In that one graphic moment, it became everyone is vulnerable, and a terrorist can do it legally in the United States. And I think that explained the whole issue to the American people in a way that they have never had it presented to them before.
But when asked if lawmakers are close to a compromise on any of these measures, Markey said no, there's no sign of compromise. So once again, despite the heated debate, it doesn't look like today's vote will result in any significant changes to the nation's gun laws.
Well, that's WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks walking us through the debate and vote coming up in the Senate today about several gun control proposals. Anthony, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
And listeners, send us a tweet. Tweet at Radio Boston and let us know what you think about what Anthony said here, that Senator Markey says that the fact that they're having a debate in the Senate is a sign of progress. But at the same time, as Anthony pointed out, today's vote will probably not result in any changes to the nation's gun laws. What do you think? Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All right, cliche alert, but there's actually a good reason why. I'm about to tell you that I loved reading Brave New World when I was a kid, mostly because Aldous Huxley's dark dystopia, where society has abolished natural reproduction in favor of artificially raising human embryos in hatcheries, it just seems so wildly impossible. However, Huxley set Brave New World in the year 2540. Here we are in the year 2016, and Harvard genetics professor George Church is telling us that in the near future, we will be able to synthesize an entire human genome from scratch, that such a future is not wildly impossible, but highly probable, and that Huxley got the phrase right, but the meaning wrong. It will be a brave new world, but brave in the best sense, not the worst. Well, recently, WBUR Common Health editor Kerry Goldberg had an extensive conversation with George Church about genomics advances coming in both the near and long terms, and the profound ethical questions that come with that. And she joins us now with more. Hi there, Kerry.
Hey, Meghna. And I know just how you feel, that it's incredible that this thing that was science fiction when we were kids is now possible. It's within the realm of the doable.
Exactly. And I mean, Huxley was looking at the year 2500. He was 500 years off, it seems. Okay. So tell us about your sit down with George Church. First of all, he's a major figure in the world of genomics. Who is he?
Yes, he really is. He's a towering figure. Actually, literally, he's towering. He's like 6'5 with a big white beard, but mainly he's a towering figure in science. He's been at the cutting edge of genetic engineering and sequencing the genome for about as long as it's been a big field. He's founded a bunch of companies, and he's renowned as really a brilliant scientist. And so when he says things like, hey, you know, we could bring back the Neanderthals or the mammoths, it's like de-extinction, or we could edit the human genome to eradicate terrible diseases, then people tend to listen. Now, remember, he's not necessarily saying we should do it, but he's saying we could. We could do it. And also, Meghna, he's extraordinarily open. Like, he's even got his own genome posted publicly. He's just right out there as a matter of principle. He believes that science should be transparent.
I've proposed some of the most open projects, like the open humans, open software hardware for sequencing. I myself am part of open humans.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a moment. But let's actually start our conversation in a more sort of down-to-earth place that you also talked to George Church about. It's about a project to release genetically engineered mice into the wild in order to stop the spread of Lyme disease. And this is actually a proposal that's on the table or maybe even in the works for Nantucket and soon will be in Martha's Vineyard. So how does it work?
Right. So just to clarify, this isn't actually George Church's project. It's his mentees, but he talked about it. And also, this is just in the very, very earliest stages of being proposed. Okay. It all depends on public approval and, of course, how the science goes. But yes, right. So the story is, well, first of all, pop quiz, Meghna. What organism causes Lyme disease?
There's a bacterium, right?
Yes, that's okay. Right. What spreads the bacterium?
Okay, so what's the deer ticks?
Yes, deer ticks. But so, and most of us know that deer ticks are connected with deer, right? Because deer ticks. But what a lot of people don't know is that the Lyme disease bacterium has a very complicated life cycle, and part of it involves mice. What happens is that the bacteria don't infect the baby ticks, the newborn ticks, but in their larval stage, the newborn ticks feed off mice, and they can catch it from the mice. So the mice are like a reservoir for the bacteria. So now we get to the proposal. So there's an MIT evolutionary biologist, Kevin Esvelt, who studied under George Church, and he's proposing to try to genetically engineer many, many thousands of mice so that they'd carry antibodies against the Lyme bacterium. So they'd be resistant, right, to the Lyme bug. And by the way, these are based on genes that have already evolved naturally in some mice. So it's not putting foreign DNA into the mice necessarily.
And so that would interrupt the life cycle somehow? Is that what the hope?
Exactly, okay. Right. So you get resistant mice and then you spread them around. He's proposing first to try it on an uninhabited island and see how that goes. And then if it works and if the community approves, then you could try releasing them on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and see if that helps, because both those islands have just hideous Lyme disease problems. And then if all that goes well, then years down the line, you could maybe release genetically engineered mice much more broadly on the mainland and possibly with more sort of powerful engineering that would help these resistance genes spread.
Okay, so this is a proposal or a project from one of George Church's mentees, as you said. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to me, it sounds like it would be great to stop worrying about Lyme,
yes.
But there are always unintended consequences.
Right. And that's why they're putting this out there early and they're asking the public, hey, this looks probable. Do you want to do this? And I asked George Church what he thinks of this proposal of his mentee, Kevin Esfeld. He says he's personally for it.
Yeah, I have a house in Connecticut and my family was definitely voting in favor. They can't wait to be able to spend more time there.
It has wrecked the outdoors, yeah.
But no matter how enthusiastic we all are personally, the important thing is to also make sure that it's done carefully and with great public awareness and engagement so that you can see every step of the way how we're doing the ecological studies, how we're doing the kind of contained studies of the gene drive, and so on, so that they can make up their mind at any moment to pull the plug or to change the direction.
And how doable is the manipulation that he's talking about? How soon would that even be plausible?
Well, so gene drives have now worked in every species that's been seriously tried in. I don't think they're working in mice yet, but certainly in insects and fungal species. But anyway, this could happen within a year where we're getting these serious field trials. But again, it depends on not just the technical progress, but the societal discussions that go around it.
Because, Meghna, you can imagine what they're talking about is altering the shared environment, and we all better have a say in what happens.
Yeah. Right? Well, mm-hmm. We are talking with WBUR's Common Health editor, Carrie Goldberg, about George Church, the Harvard geneticist, who has some very interesting proposals about directions that genomics research could go, both in the long term and the near term. And we're also going to talk about the sort of ethical considerations around that. So, Carrie, hang on mm-hmm. for just a second, because I want to introduce someone else into the conversation, Lori Zoloth. She's a professor of medical humanities and bioethics and a professor of religious studies at Northwestern University. She's been thinking a lot about the ethical considerations around gene-based research. She joins us now. Professor Zoloth, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, really, I know your area of expertise is in how we tinker with the human genome, and we're going to get to that in a second. But I did want your reaction to the sort of nearer-term example of how we could use genomics research in our immediate environment vis-a-vis these hopefully Lyme disease-resistant mice. What do you think?
So I actually heard Kevin Esfeld give this paper in December of this year, and I was fascinated by it, as the entire room was, because it uses the mouse, not the tick, as the target, right? So the reason turns out to be that mice have much shorter reproductive cycles than ticks, which live longer
yeah, who
and
knew?
More slowly. Who knew? Who knew? Yeah. Right? So, and then I thought deer had to be involved, but oh no, it's the mice. So he's doing several things that make this ethically interesting and defensible. The first, of course, is he's having public discussions with people who will be most dramatically affected, the inhabitants of the islands mm-hmm. that are going to be test cases for his idea. He's first doing on an uninhabited island, and he's secondly asking the people that interact with that ecosystem what they think about this dramatic change. Now, it seems simple, but what you're doing is making mice more powerful in a sense. They can resist this disease. It could go very well. Let's hope that it does. And I'm glad he's doing it in slow steps with consent. It could, of course, as I said to Professor Esfeld, it could, of course, destroy the ecosystem in some unintended way that he has no idea will happen. That's why you tested first with very few species on a very contained space.
Well, can I just jump in here and ask you a quick question? Because I feel like you've just gotten to what is sort of one of the heart of the matter when it comes to any of this research, whether it be on mice or on humans. And that's this question of how should science and researchers deal with considerations of unintended consequences? I mean, I know that there's a very strong argument that the science and scientists themselves are just focused on the science, and we as society have to think about the unintended consequences. But certainly, how do we have that discussion? Where should that discussion begin?
Well, let's begin with understanding that some consequences will be unintended and are completely unknown. Therefore, it has to be worth it to take that sort of chance with humanity, even with an island in the middle of the Atlantic, right? It has to be worth it. So Lyme disease is an enormously important problem, especially for people who live on the East Coast. It does change how humans relate to the outdoors, and when you get serious cases of Lyme disease can be devastating. So it seems like the people who are most affected could make that decision for themselves and for their island. Whether it should be widely spread up and down the East Coast, that's another sort of question. And maybe we would like to spend some time going slowly through this process and seeing what the effects are. Of course, the long-term and generational effects can't be known. If the mice are more resistant to this disease, does that give them immunity to something else? What happens if the mice population overgrows? Then how do we have to intervene? But those things, if they're taken slowly, can be handled piece by piece, again, with the consent of the people on the island.
Right.
But that's why using gene drives for, say, malaria, to me, seems much more important and much more ethically sound, right? Because that's a devastating disease. Every 30 minutes, someone, usually a child, dies of malaria. Even as we speak here on this program, reflecting upon it, actual children are dying at a terrible rate.
Yeah. So let me just jump in here.
You can be used there.
Yeah, let me just jump in here for a second because you used the word slowly, but the question is the science is going ever faster. And I want to actually use that to turn to this other idea, Carrie, that George Church has about synthesizing a human genome and that could be coming somewhere down the line. So first of all, what does George Church mean when he says that?
So George Church is talking about not just reading or sequencing the existing human genome, the full set of our genes, but actually writing a human genome, meaning that you would build it. You're not just reading it, you're actually creating it. So the idea is you would build a full set of human genes from scratch, the way you would make a, I mean, it's not completely from nothing. It's like if you make a cake from scratch, you have the eggs and the sugar and the flour. But you could basically manufacture our blueprint from chemicals and conceivably create a human being without parents. And so I think of it as, you know, it's not just in vitro fertilization. It's like in vitro genesis or in vitro creation, which, of course, it's, you know, it's fun to think about. It's wild. It's maybe like playing God in the lab. But it's that, according to George Church, is not the point. He says that actually it could make sense scientifically.
Let's say you wanted to change the genetic code so that you can make a cell line for manufacturing drugs, vaccines, antibodies, and so forth. That manufacturing, if you wanted to be the virus resistant, changing the genetic code is one way of doing that. And if you change the genetic code of every protein in the cell, in the genome, you might as well have synthesized the whole genome. That's our experience in bacteria, where we've done exactly that.
So basically what you're saying is the technology was at the point where it was time to start talking about doing this, right? And I gather the timescale could be within a few years.
Yeah,
could
I mean, to some extent, we're already doing it. We're synthesizing bigger and bigger genomes. And I like to bring up these things as far in advance as you can, although it seems like we're driving faster through the fog than ever before. We're getting a little ahead of our headlights. So it could be 5 years, 10 years before we've brought the price down so that anybody can basically synthesize any large genome that they want. And it's time to be thinking not just about the technological implications and commercial, but also ethical and societal implications.
Let's talk about those. What's the conversation that you would like to be beginning now about the societal and ethical implications?
Well, we've already had some of these conversations, but it's just good to just renew them and refresh and ask if there's something new. I mean, for example, we've had conversations about consent of cells, you know, sort of the HeLa cells. Rebecca Skloot brought this to many people's attention.
And then there's the sci-fi aspect, right, which is you sort of start thinking, so you could create a human from scratch.
I have nothing against sci-fi, especially if it's approaching reality. The way that we're currently configuring the project has nothing to do with this, first of all, but it's okay to talk beyond the project. Even in the most radically engineered genomes, it's not like we make random bases of A, C's, T's, and G's. You know, it's based on something, and whoever that closest person is effectively a parent. I saw some ethicist, I can't remember who it was, saying that the problem with parentless children is that they have no history, they have no richness of inheritance. But, you know, this kind of condemns whole lot of people who are orphans and or otherwise put up for adoption. And I think that it's not that fundamental a bit of humanity is that you know who your parents are.
Well, that's George Church. He's one of the nation's leading geneticists and a Harvard University professor, speaking with WBUR's Carrie Goldberg. My head is swimming, Carrie.
It's
with
pretty wild.
All the possibilities.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. Now, of course, it will be years and years, but still, it raises these crazy questions. Like one of my favorite ones that was in an essay was, well, so should we build a bunch of Einsteins then? How many Einsteins do we want?
Yeah, my starting the segment with Brave New World seems actually apt because it feels like we're there. Let's turn back now again to Lori Zola. She's a professor of medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Professor Zola, we heard George Church sort of outline some of where he would think that the ethical center of gravity lies in the synthetic human genome research that he's proposing. I mean, you heard him there mention the question of consent. Is that one of the more important questions to you?
This is a very different discussion than the discussions we've had previously about genetic engineering, where we think about a disease, we think about the genetic cause, we think about using, say, one of those new techniques like CRISPR-Cas9 to make changes in an existing genome, or stem cell research, where you think about creating a line of stem cells that would be useful for patching up parts of the organisms, right? This is an ontologically different project of taking chemicals that you order online from a lab and string them together to make a human genome, or to make any genome. In fact, we just had a chilling discussion about the use of assault guns as weapons, and this is very close to the room in which people talk about making biological bacteria, not just cheerful, friendly ones, but dangerous ones, mm-hmm. right? So this is technology that has to be very carefully thought through, regulated, and you have to ask the ethical question of the nature, goal, and meaning of this work in general. Why we give scientists so much money and attention and praise, and why we honor them so much, is because they're after a quest to end human suffering or to alleviate human suffering. So therefore, they have enormous capacities, but they have to use them very carefully and only after the kind of public discourse and public discussion that I know George Church is interested in. When you're driving ahead of your headlights, you better slow down because it's not safe, especially to other people who happen to be in your way. And it's only barely excusable if you're rushing to save a life. But in this case, we're developing a technology with no immediate use that couldn't be done better with genetic manipulation and genetic modification of existing genomes.
Let me ask you, this is maybe an echo of my earlier question, but it's kind of the one that I really fundamentally grapple with. Is how much of the responsibility should we be putting on scientists, right? Because, I mean, I'm thinking back to the many scientists who work to split the atom, right? I mean, one could say that absolutely they knew what the goal was. The goal was to build a bomb that could split the atom. But at the time, they were also saying, well, our fundamental job as basic scientists and researchers is simply to expand human knowledge. And it's up to society to decide how that knowledge is then put into place and used in practice. So, you know, when you said that we revere scientists and we give them an extraordinary amount of power, I mean, aren't we as society equally powerful in deciding when to slow the car down with the headlights analogy?
So that's a good story, because that bomb was developed in a situation of war, and it was only justifiable to stop a war that was slaughtering millions and millions of people. And that's the only justification for that. It's a shaky justification even in retrospect, right? But the thought came after of how to regulate this powerful technology, and it was from a strong social movement, both from within scientists themselves, scientists who were concerned about their social responsibility, and from without. You know, Mothers Against Nuclear Weapons, a mainstay of the 1960s anti-nuclear movement. Maybe it went too far. We can actually say, gee, maybe if we had developed nuclear technology instead of using carbon fuel, maybe we'd be in a different situation now, for, you know, facing catastrophic global warming. But at least we paid attention to the just concerns that this would be a weapon of war that would be ending an entire planet.
Right.
And that planetary view is what these big discussions bring forward, and that's why we have to have them about this kind of interesting but radical technology of creating a new human genome.
Well, on that point, and just briefly because we're flat out of time here, but I want just to ask you both, Carrie and Lori, there have been some conversations specifically around the synthetic genome project that's been proposed, but they've been behind closed doors. Lori Zoloth, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
There was one meeting, and it was an unusual meeting because it was by invitation only. But the thing that made it unusual was that people were prohibited from speaking to the press, and that was our concern. Usually science meetings such as this can be accounted for. You say, yes, we're going to this meeting, and it's by invitation only, but it's not a secret. And so, but we've moved on beyond that concern, and now you're having a discussion, the two of you, the three of us, with George, and we're looking forward to broadening that discussion in the coming months and inviting many more people into the conversation, and I hope you join us.
And Carrie, would you join those conversations?
I would want a front row seat, I think, just because, you know, I feel like this is one of the most interesting intersections between science and society of our time. Like, there are some historians who write that the thing that's the most unique about now is that we humans are gaining the ability to take direct control of evolution. So, like, wow, but yikes.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can read her post about exactly what's been proposed for Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and more about George Church as well. We've got a link to that at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you.
Welcome.
And Lori Zoloth, professor of medical humanities and bioethics and professor of religious studies at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to the conversation, and I hope it continues.
Same as do I. And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Let us know what you think about the ethics around genomics research. Send us a comment at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so in the last segment, the literary reference was to Brave New World. In this segment, it's Call Me Ishmael. That's, of course, the very beginning of one of America's greatest novels, Moby Dick. But how much do we really know about the passions that spurred Herman Melville to write his novel? And how much do we have to guess about what happened? Well, novelist Mark Beauregard makes a few guesses in his new novel called The Whale, A Love Story. And in it, he writes that it was the relationship between Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne that made Moby Dick so charged with that incredible deep passion. And Mark Beauregard joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so this is a really fascinating novel about the relationship between Hawthorne and Melville. What exactly do we know in reality about how much interaction the two writers had?
Quite a bit, and it's been the subject of speculation for scholars for generations. We have Melville's letters to Hawthorne, which survived, and we have Hawthorne's journal entries. And we also have the letters and journals of their family and friends. There was an incredible literary community that sprang up in the Berkshires in the 1840s and 50s. And all of them wrote letters madly all the time and kept private journals. And so we have a great deal of evidence about who they were and what they did.
So in your novel, though, you make this, I'm not even sure if I'd call it a leap because I think there has been some discussion about it, but you set the story that the relationship that we're talking about was more than just, you know, two writers of similar temperament, that their relationship was something deeper than that.
In fact, scholars have talked about the influence of Hawthorne on Moby Dick and on Melville for literally decades, since the 1920s. But no one quite explained why Melville's letters were so passionate and why their relationship caused such a change in Melville's work. Because Moby Dick is different from all the other books that he wrote. It's different in form, especially. And I think the relationship between Hawthorne and Melville accounts for this in many ways.
So different, I mean, it is significantly different, but are you saying that you feel that, like, there was a profound, like, romantic love between the two men that inspired Melville to make such a great leap with Moby Dick?
I think there's no question that Melville was in love with Hawthorne. The question is to what extent Hawthorne returned Melville's feelings and exactly what the nature of those feelings are.
Okay.
The interesting thing about the letters exchanged between the two men is that Melville's survived, but Hawthorne asked that Melville destroy his letters, which he did. which was the first thing that got me interested in their relationship, because so the question is, why would you want someone to destroy your letters? And when Sophia Hawthorne, Nathaniel's wife, was preparing his journals for publication after Hawthorne died, she blacked out significant portions relating to Melville and their nights together when they would stay up until 3 a.m. drinking brandy. And we know about those passages because some clever researchers from Harvard went back to the originals and x-rayed the parts that she had blacked out.
Wow.
And found out that they referred to Melville. So this set me on an odyssey of exploration. Why was this? What were they hiding, if anything?
Wow. Okay. So Melville, as you've mentioned, also dedicated Moby Dick to Nathaniel Hawthorne. And he writes in the dedication, "In token of my admiration for his genius." Now, in a lost letter, Hawthorne responds favorably to the book, and then that prompted Melville's response on November 17 of 1851. And we have that letter, right? That's one of the ones that you use for your research. Could you read a little bit of that?
I'd love to. And I'll mention ahead of time that Melville uses the word magians, an old form for magician. "My dear Hawthorne, if the world was entirely made up of magians, I'll tell you what I should do. I should have a paper mill established at one end of the house, and so have an endless ribbon of foolscap rolling in upon my desk. And upon that endless ribbon, I should write 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000 thoughts, all under the form of a letter to you. The divine magnet is on you, and my magnet responds. Which is the biggest? A foolish question. They are one." And then actually a little bit later in that letter, he says, "Whence come you, Hawthorne? By what right do you drink from my flagon of life? And when I put it to my lips, lo, they are yours and not mine."
Oh, interesting. So that's from an 1851 letter from Herman Melville to Nathaniel Hawthorne. I'm curious, though, we're looking at this through 21st century eyes, and could we perhaps be wrong to ascribing sort of a homoerotic sensibility to these letters, whereas it's possible in the 19th century people would write such, maybe big R romantic letters to each other because that was simply a means of expression and connection at the time?
We could be wrong, but I don't think we are.
Okay.
And the reason is this, that even though you're right that men expressed friendly affection for one another in much more intimate terms than we do today, these letters are unusual even in that context. And there's a wonderful book by Graham Robb called Strangers, which explores this very topic. He talks about how men behaved with each other in public, how they wrote to each other, the different standards of affection that they expressed. And I believe, anyone can look at the letters. They're available online at melville.org and a million other places. And you can judge for yourself whether you think this is merely friendly.
Yeah. So I'm thinking all of a sudden of another sort of contemporary of Melville's and Hawthorne's, and that would be Walt Whitman, who it seems there is a lot of scholarship about how he actually lived his life and in his literature as well. And many biographers believe he actually had male lovers at different times. But is there any sort of that kind of direct evidence about Hawthorne or Melville?
Well, there's no direct evidence, such as a note that said, "I really enjoyed last night," and explains exactly what happened. But there's so much circumstantial evidence that I was persuaded. And if Melville did have a love relationship with Hawthorne, it explains many things about Moby Dick that are otherwise somewhat difficult to explain, beginning with the dedication, but not least the fact that there's a representation of a marriage between two men in Moby Dick. In chapter 10, Ishmael and Queequeg get married. And that would be a very strange thing for a normative heterosexual man to be thinking or writing about in 1850.
Yeah. Well, finally, before we run out of time, I do want to give listeners a little sense to how you put all the scholarship that you put together in the novel, The Whale. And there's a wonderful passage where you go inside Herman Melville's head. And I was wondering if you could just read that to us.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. "Herman was sitting quietly at the head of the table, staring into the fire, his mind far out to sea. His days had become an exhausting blur of fictional whales, farming chores, and a constant needling longing for Hawthorne, made worse by Hawthorne's continuing refusal to answer his letter. He was writing his whaling adventure at Hawthorne now, channeling all of his frustrations and affections, which he could express to no one in real life, into the operatic desires of his fishy allegory that he hoped would out Hawthorne, a revelation of masculine beauty that Hawthorne could not help but recognize as an act of love."
That's Mark Beauregard reading an excerpt from his new novel, The Whale, A Love Story. Mark is going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. Last question in the last couple of seconds that we have. Did your research and reading of this, or writing the novel The Whale, did it really change how you look at Moby Dick as a work of literature?
It completely changed my idea of Moby Dick. In fact, after I had done a couple of years of research just to check myself, I reread it, and it opened all kinds of new possibilities and avenues for reading it. It was beautiful. And so I really, as skeptical as I was in the beginning, I am a complete convert now.
Well, that's Mark Beauregard. His new novel is The Whale, A Love Story. And as I said, he'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. And tomorrow at Paper Cuts in JP, also at 7. We've got information about both those events at WBUR.org/Radio Boston. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.